You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast. Number 149.
From the 4th of July. Come on, do I really need 6 months to shop? Might as well be Christmas nonstop. Pretty soon they'll be hanging up lights all over town. And it was just last week I finally took mine down. Please, can I get a break for my sake? All I'm asking for is 1 month without a fruitcake. Give me some time to recover from another year of drunken relatives and a pissed off little brother. Singing that stupid Jingle Bell song in the middle of July somehow seems wrong.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Glad to be back. Well, it's that time of year again. That was a clip from The Christmas Season by Devo Spice. He's a comedy rapper from New Jersey who has become one of the most popular artists on the nationally syndicated Dr. Demento show. I think you'll enjoy it. I'll play the full song at the end of my podcast.
It's Christmas time again.
This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. My topic today is Teaching in a Digital Age. That happens to be the title of a book written by Tony Bates, and I have the pleasure of interviewing him the other day. Tony is the CEO of Tony Bates Associates Limited and a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. Tony was the former director of distance education technology at the University of British Columbia. We discuss a lot of the underlying principles that guide effective teaching in this new age of technology. We touch on the kinds of skills that are needed in a digital age, the changing nature of knowledge, how we learn best, the role of publishers, future of MOOCs, and many more topics. So I hope you enjoy it. Here's my interview with Dr. Tony Bates. Tony, thanks so much for agreeing to speak with me today. I understand you're talking to us from Vancouver.
That's right.
Why don't you give my audience just a little bit of your background, how you got involved in teaching and in sort of the technology aspects of it?
Sure. Yeah, I started, I was a teacher by training, and I started doing research at the Open University in the United Kingdom when it was first set up in 1969. My job was to basically find out what had already been written or whatever research had been done in distance education before the university got started, and then make sure that information got out to the right people. And one of the very early things I started finding out was that students reacted very differently from – we were collecting data on student reactions and student responses to the first courses. And we noted a very distinct difference between the way they reacted to the television programs from the print-based materials. The print television programs were made by the BBC for the Open University. And I was interested in that. It was basically a difference between emotion and rationality. There was a lot of rationality about how students responded to the print-based materials, but a lot of emotion, often hostile to the TV programs.
Interesting.
So I ended up as a professor of educational media research after 20 years of doing not just research into television and radio, but also into new technologies as they started coming along, like video discs, video cassettes, and so on. And so I ended up as a general researcher in educational media, mainly focused on evaluating the Open University's own products.
Interesting. I'll tell my audience that I met you at a recent conference at Drexel, one of our neighbors here in Philadelphia, and it was very timely meeting you and listening to your talk and also reading your book. We're going through a strategic planning process right now, and I'm on a committee that's looking at the future of education. So I thought, wow, this is you're the person to talk to. And I have a whole list of questions. I'm not sure how much how far we're going to get into it, but and certainly I'll have a link on my show notes to your book, which is free. Is that's right? Is it to anybody who wants it?
Yes, it's an open online textbook.
It's great. You know, in looking at it, I think, boy, this should be a required text for all of our faculty. Speaking of the digital age, you talk about what some new skills are that are needed in the digital age. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. You know, there's a lot of general talk about 21st century skills and so on, but I'm not sure it's altogether a helpful term, because some of those skills we've been teaching for a long time in universities, like critical thinking, for instance. But I think the focus in my experience in working with universities, particularly campus-based ones, is there is a heavy emphasis on content over skills. And I think the big challenge for content, there are two challenges. First of all, the content base is constantly changing. We're learning more and more. We're getting more and more content, basically, not always good quality, but also sometimes very good quality new content. And the content is expanding more rapidly than we can accommodate in a four-year program or even an eight-year postgraduate plus undergraduate program. So students really need to, skills that will allow them to go on learning after they've graduated, but also will know how to handle and manage all that expanding content, both of good and poor quality. So as equally as important as knowing things is knowing how to evaluate them and how to find them and how to organize them and how to communicate them and how to apply them. And I don't think we are explicit enough in post-secondary education, in higher education, in actually embedding that deliberately into our teaching. Now, there is a lot of implicit development of those skills, particularly in the humanities, but it's assumed somehow that students will pick these up without it ever being explicitly taught. And one of the things that online learning does, it forces you to be very explicit about what you're doing. You can't make assumptions about what the students will learn from you. You have to be very explicit about that. And so one of the things I think that online learning can do is to really help students develop those skills, partly because they need to use online learning in order to acquire skills such as knowledge management. They're going to have to go out to the internet and decide, if I'm reading this research article and I notice, you know, I'm studying medicine, do I need to know whether it's published or been supported by a pharmaceutical company or whether it's academic research? And if so, what difference would that make to my interpretation of the research? So it's that aspect that's equally important as knowing where the research articles are.
Yeah, certainly, as you mentioned, knowledge management, critical thinking. Are there other explicit skills that...
Well, independent learning, the ability to go on learning after you've left university, often implicit. We expect students, if they're well-educated, once they left, to go on learning. But online learning in particular provides a discipline for, you know, it's your responsibility as an online learner, particularly to make sure the work gets done. And it can be a challenge for students sometimes when they're used to having, you know, they have to turn up at class every day. That's easy, you know, you turn up at class. But actually, when you don't have to turn up at class, but you still got to do the work, then that requires some discipline, and that carries over, I think, after they've left. We often hear, incidentally, from anecdotally, I can't provide research for this, from faculty, that often students who've taken online courses often start better in graduate programs than students who haven't. And again, I think it's more to do with them being more independent in their learning, not waiting to be told what to do.
This topic reminds me of the election we've been through here recently in this country, and being able to distinguish real news from fake news and the role that critical thinking would take there.
Well, I'm not going to comment on the U.S. We have enough problems with our own politics in Canada, but it certainly brought home to me very clearly, and this is one of the side effects of one of the core effects of social media is that identifying the sources of information and their reliability and the context in which they're provided, I think that is an important skill. But I want to go further than that and say, well, that's a sort of generic skill that we all need. But I'm saying that even in very academic areas, we need that kind of approach to learning. And one of the things that leads to is, in my view, we need to shift a little bit from delivery of content in the sense that in many ways, the instructor is often doing the knowledge management. They're the ones selecting the knowledge to be taught, organizing it, putting their spin on it, and so on. And really, we want those skills transferable or developed perhaps by the students, which changes the role of the faculty member.
That's right. It sounds to me more like the apprentice model, where you learn by doing, and then you come back to your mentor to have your learning refined.
Yeah, and I think we do that much better in postgraduate studies. But I think I'm coming around to the view that really, you know, when students first come into the university, we should be asking them right from the beginning, because these are skills, and it takes a long time to develop a skill. It's not something that you can just do once and then that's it. You know, you're going to have to, and you get better at skills, you know, so the more you practice them, the better you get. So in a sense, I think we should be looking at some of these skills on a programmatic basis rather than just on an individual course basis, for instance.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. One thing I noticed in your book was your reference to the changing nature of knowledge. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I'm ambivalent about that. I mean, I think that academic knowledge certainly isn't changing that rapidly in the sense of the nature of the knowledge. I mean, particularly if you're in the sciences, it's empirically based. It has a set of standards and criteria. I don't think that's changing very much. Maybe it is a bit more on the humanities, and it's a pretty good course to run. You know, is knowledge changing in the humanities, our concept of knowledge? But I think that knowledge is much more friable or much more less easily defined nowadays. And, you know, it comes back to things like post-truth and so on. You know, the post-truth stuff reminds me sort of the phase of postmodernism that the social sciences went through, when everything was questioned about its, you know, comparative validity, that anything could be challenged. And then we seem to, I'm not sure if that's still being taught in the social sciences, but we seem to have moved on from that. But it's coming up again now with social media, where you really have to question sources of all kinds of information.
Right. You know, it reminds me of Stephen Colbert, who used to talk about truthiness. The nature of truth changing on depending on who's talking, I guess, at the time. In terms of learning, we've often talked about, you know, different modes of learning and having multiple modalities available to our students. What's your view on how we learn best, or is it totally individual? Do we learn best by listening, by talking, by doing?
If you put more emphasis on skills, it's a different kind of learning than if you're putting emphasis on content. Content's mainly about comprehension, understanding, and often memory. Whereas skills is more about doing things, especially intellectually doing things. So we could say, in a sense, that what's needed now is a movement towards that kind of learning. Now, that I want to be careful here, because skills are so very much dependent often on content. You've got to know stuff before you can do stuff. So it's not that skills are more important than content. It's just the emphasis that we give to skills in our teaching. So when that comes to learning, then the thing that bothers me most about particularly post-secondary education is that we know a lot about learning and how people learn, how students learn. We're also getting, even from neuroscience now, much better indications of how students learn and what are the barriers or the conditions for learning. Yet most faculty who teach in universities know nothing of this research unless they're actual psychologists or working in that field. So we haven't done a very good job of looking at how we prepare our faculty for teaching so that we embed those lessons we know about how students best learn into our teaching, so that we can encourage students to learn in a more efficient and more effective way than we do. For instance, lectures are a very poor means of teaching certainly some of those skills that I talked about. Pretty good for condensing content and for organizing content and things like that, but not very good for developing skills of application, for instance, or independent learning skills. So again, I think that we're not matching the methods of teaching very well, or the traditional methods of teaching don't match very well with the kinds of learning that we're now looking, that we ought to be developing in our students.
That's right. You know, I've been teaching for, 25 or 30 years. It's not been my main job lately, but I never had any formal training on how to teach. I certainly picked up some good pointers, I think, from my good teachers and maybe some of my bad teachers and my mentor, certainly. I can remember sitting in lectures as a student and hearing, this is a medical school, where the professor talked about minutiae from their own research and really left the students in the dust. And I think it wasn't a great use of their time.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy for faculty here because all the emphasis on in their training is on research and getting publications, and there's very little reward for teaching. Even after they got tenure, the main rewards come from research. So there's a double problem here, that if you want to teach differently, first of all, there's little reward for doing it, and secondly, we don't often help faculty in order to teach differently. If you don't have a good understanding of pedagogy and how students learn, then it's very difficult to adapt your teaching to new ways of doing things, like teaching online, for instance. You've got to have a pedagogical base behind that. So one of the things I'm seeing happening, it seems to be in some ways, although there are costs involved in doing this, is a move towards more team teaching, where particularly for, say, very large first-year classes, you redesign them with the faculty member working with a team, including teaching assistants, but also instructional designers as well. The expertise is shared around. The faculty got control. Faculty members got control of the content, the learning outcomes, the main assessment methods. But the instructional designer is able to help with the design of the teaching, and the faculty member becomes more like a supervisor then of the teaching assistants, or sometimes adjunct faculty, who work directly with the students, but the senior faculty member is more like a consultant over the teaching. And I think that model will become necessary more and more over time.
Absolutely. You know, as we expand some of our online programs here, my department is responsible for a lot of this and helping our faculty. And we have a very well-defined process for working with faculty to develop an online course. But when it comes to the existing face-to-face courses, I think there's a lot of room for improvement and using, different pedagogies and new technologies.
Well, that's the good side, though, because what's happening now is that at one time we had face-to-face learning done on campus and continuing studies looking after distance education, and online learning started as fully online and distance education. But what we're seeing now is more and more faculty beginning, and more and more students particularly, beginning to learn online, even though they're in campus-based courses. So they're doing exercises at home online. Often the textbooks come with online activities and so on. So we are seeing faculty having to deal now with this issue of, should I just be trying to add online on top of everything I'm doing in the classroom, or should I be really rethinking my whole teaching process and focusing in class on what's best done in class, and online what's best done online? And I think that's going to become a much more critical question over the next few years. I think people will start initially, as we've done with flipped classrooms, of taking a kind of lecture model, putting the lecture bit on video, and then bringing the students in for discussion. Then the faculty member starts to think, well, maybe I could use video a bit better than that. Maybe I could show them some things on video and go out and collect some data or something like that, and then discuss that in class. So again, I think we're going to see more of that kind of thinking more carefully about, why should the student get on the bus and come into the campus? Am I really making it worth their while when I know they can do a lot of the stuff online at home?
It's funny, I just had a discussion today about publishers and the role that they might play. And, you know, I think the forward thinking publishers are realizing that, you know, textbooks are maybe not the dead end, but certainly need to bend and adjust with the times. Can you think of any publishers that are doing the right thing? What do you think their role is in the future of teaching and learning?
That's a difficult question. I think we will see a lot of the very standard first year courses that are taught, you know, first year physics 100, physics 101, you know, they're pretty much same content everywhere you go. The faculty may be better in some places than others, but the content's pretty standard. And in British Columbia, in my province now, there's an open textbook project, and they've got about 165 open textbooks. They're freely downloadable by the students. That's why I was able to do my book as an online textbook. And I think that will take away a big market from the publishers. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It's saving students millions of dollars, and it's really hard to turn that clock back once it starts running. So where I think the publishers will still have a very important role to play is in the more specialized textbooks. But then, of course, that's not such a big market for them as the traditional market. And then I think companies like Pearson have been very smart in taking those big first-year textbooks and adding all kinds of supplementary material, which makes the faculty members' job easier. And it's, after all, the faculty that chooses the books, not the students, but it's the students who have to pay for them. So I think it's a very smart move by publishers adding all this extra material, because to do that with open textbooks, it's really hard to find a business model where that would work.
Right. How about the learning management companies, learning management providers? Do you have any view on how they need to improve? Are any of them doing the right thing in your mind?
You know, I have a very simplistic view of a learning management system. I think of it like a filing cabinet. You know, it's a way of organizing your content, and a way of not just content, of also, you know, you have discussion forums and so on. But it's a place where you organize things. And I think you're going to go on needing that, even, you know, in some kind of box in which to put stuff. And, you know, students need to know, particularly if they're studying mainly fully online, what they have to do each week, not just the content they have to learn, but when are the assignments due, and so on. So you need that kind of organizational structure around a course. So I think the learning management system will stay. I think the big danger to them is other software coming along that's more networked, like social media, and more movement to get students to create material. Again, coming back to that developing skills, then, you know, one way to develop skills is to give students projects or problems to solve, and they create the materials, and then that gets evaluated, and they're developing the materials, and they need tools that they can get in and use easily, more easily than, say, a learning management system. And they may want to open up the course a bit more so that other people can contribute besides the students to the course, for instance. So those are the kind of challenges, I think, that learning – and the other one, of course, is lecture capture. Will faculty prefer just to do the recorded lecture and have a kind of server that enables that to be easily downloaded if they start integrating it with their classroom teaching, or will they still need a learning management system? I suspect they will. It's easier to integrate a video into a learning management system. You just click it on the URL and then download the video or stream the video. So I think learning management systems will stay, but I think you'll see a lot of bells and whistles or other stuff integrated with them or organized around them.
One thing that intrigued me, I'm familiar with the term agile design as it applies to certainly computer programming. How is agile design applied to teaching and learning?
That's a good question. I haven't seen many instances of it, unfortunately. There's two kinds of agile design. There's the kind that's used a lot in corporate training, which is very quick design. Get something done very quickly and out the door. One of the big problems about the standard online course is that if you use the ADDIE model, the instructional design model, it takes a long time. It takes 6 months before the course starts in the design and going through all the steps and so on. what we're seeing now, again, it's more to do with the skills development and moving some of the work towards the students. Instead of putting up that front-end, heavy content-based course, you start off with getting the students to identify problems and get them working on collecting the content and organizing it and interpreting it. And I've seen a couple of courses like that, not necessarily online. One very good one is the Integrated Science Program at McMaster in Canada, where students start immediately doing research in their first year of undergraduate teaching. They give them big projects, for instance, around the environment or around space exploration, and then they start off immediately trying to identify what the issues are, what the problems are, in discussion with the faculty, of course, and with each other. And then the faculty develops a program around that or a set of work for that for the students to do, and they do research. And their actual assessment is the research they do and how useful it is. And that's a very interesting program, and it allows them to work on a project, for instance, over half a semester or a whole semester or even more sometimes. And what you're doing is integrating all the different sciences within that to solve the particular problem they're looking at. And sometimes they're not just sciences. Often they bring in psychology or something from outside the science field where it's relevant. So I'm seeing more and more of that kind of and you have to be pretty agile in that design because you're not quite sure where the students are going to go. And you have to be flexible as a faculty member in steering them away from things if they feel it's a dead end, or encouraging them to other areas that might give them a quicker return on what they're looking for. The other is in a business program where students were came in the first week and put into groups. And what they have to do there is to look at emerging technologies and how you can build a business around that. And so basically at the end of the course, they have to come up with a business plan and a YouTube video pitch for the business. And again, the students choose the technology, and then the instructors have to work and help them guide them. Of course, there's certain stable elements, like they have to do a business plan, so they have to know about business planning. They have to do marketing and so on, so they have to know about marketing. But again, it has to be adapted to the kind of technology the students have chosen to build a business around. So again, that's a more flexible design because you can't plan everything beforehand. You can put some things in place, like how to develop a business plan, but other things you can't. You're going to have to be much more agile to deal with them. And one of the good things about that is that, you know, it keeps the cost down. You don't have to have this very lengthy pre-development period like you often have to do with fully online courses. You get straight into the teaching and then you adapt as you go.
Right.
But you be a very confident and very skilled instructor to be able to handle that kind of teaching.
Well, a couple of things that you've been talking about remind me. I also feel like I have to give a plug to this software. You may or may not know about it. It actually came out of Drexel University, their law school. It's called ApprendNet, and it's precisely designed to help students learn by doing, and especially around skills. And it's a video-based program. It actually, the company's name changed to Practice, which is what it's all about. So in a nutshell, you know, the instructor puts out a challenge. It could be a case study or something. Could be any sort of a challenge for the students, something they really haven't learned much about yet. And the students respond by uploading their own video. And so it could be skills-based, you know, interviewing or whatever. And then that unlocks the next stage, which allows peer review to go on. So a little bit of collaborative or peer learning happens where the students see what their peers are doing and give them feedback and maybe even rank them. And then they finally get to unlock the last stage where they can see, you know, what the instructor would how they would have answered that particular challenge. So we use it here at University of the Sciences, and I always like to give them a plug.
The university I'm working with, Ryerson, has a law practice program where students, after they graduated from law school, before they go into practice, they have to take this online program. And what they've done is create virtual law firms with working in collaboration with the Law Society of Upper Canada. The volunteer lawyers work with the students. They bring real cases to them, and the students work with the mentor, basically. It's a mentoring system. So the half the program is fully online. The other half is located in an actual law firm. It's kind of an apprenticeship type of program, mm-hmm. but it's a virtual program for half of the program anyway, and it's proved immensely successful. The companies really like this program because one of the problems they had is that although students knew law, they didn't know how law firms worked, which is not the same thing at all. And now they're getting students coming straight in who can start on day one.
They should look into ApprendNet because that's exactly why that was developed.
Right.
A couple more questions. I guess, what's your feeling about MOOCs? Now, a number of years ago, there was a lot of hype about them. Is that fading out, or where do you see MOOCs going?
Well, MOOCs are very interesting, and they've been important in that they kind of, what's the word I want? They legitimized online learning to some extent. Because it came from Harvard and MIT, then it got the attention of, you know, other universities and colleges around the world. And I think, you know, the issue of scale is an important one. You know, how do you scale up education? Can you get economies of scale and so on? And so it was an attempt to deal with that. But I think they found a niche now, and I think the niche is more in continuing education than it is in developing credit programs. I see MOOCs as a modern form of educational broadcasting. You know, if you watch the History Channel, you wouldn't expect to watch every program, and you wouldn't think you're a historian at the end right. of it, but you certainly learned something about history. And I see MOOCs very much in the same way.
Let's end with one last question I have, and it's very timely from my point of view here. And just looking sort of blue sky, what do you think are the most important trends affecting education looking 5 to 10 years out?
I think we have to accept now that most content is going to be open and easily accessible, and students will come less and less to universities, particularly for content, and much more for support in their learning. I'll give you an example. My grandson has just gone into studied university, and he goes to lectures, and his friends, there's about 8 of them, they take turns to go into the lecture, and what they do is take note of the topics, send the email of the topics around to their friends, and then friends then go on to the MIT Open Courseware to view the videos of the topics at their leisure, so to speak. Now, basically, you know, what we're saying is that eventually content will be freely available everywhere. So what is the value added of going to a specific university? And I think that's going to be developing the skills I mentioned and helping students find their way around the content, knowledge management and so on, that I started with. But it's more to do with the fact that knowledge is out there. You don't have to go to a particular one place to get it. It's not to say that an individual faculty member in an individual institution doesn't have something of value to add. They do, but it's going to be added to a much wider base of knowledge that students can easily access. I mean, students have always been able to do that, been able to go to libraries and so on, but it's not been so easy to do and so at your fingertips as it is now. And that does change things. It does change the way that students learn. And I think we need to be cognizant of that, and that teaching in the sense of supporting learners is going to become more important when students choose a university.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a great discussion. I look forward to finishing your book. I mean, it's a wonderful resource, and I'm certainly going to promote that here. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and my audience.
Well, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. Certainly take advantage of his book, Teaching in a Digital Age. There's a link to it on my show notes. And again, it's free. You can download the PDF. It's quite a work, and I would certainly recommend that to faculty and instructional designers this day and age. Stay tuned for The Christmas Season by Devo Spice. Little humor before the holidays. Until next time, best of the holidays to you, and Happy New Year as well. Bye for now. Christmas is coming out.
Christmas is coming. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas already, with the animated reindeer in the top hat wearing Yeti. Now I can be as festive as the next guy, but I still have firecrackers from the 4th of July. Come on, do I really need 6 months to shop? Might as well be Christmas nonstop. Pretty soon they'll be hanging up lights all over town, and it was just last week I finally took mine down. Please, can I get a break for my sake? All I'm asking for is 1 month without a fruitcake. Give me some time to recover from another year of drunken relatives and a pissed off little brother. Singing that stupid Jingle Bell song in the middle of July somehow seems wrong. I still got 5 months to go, and I'm already sick of the ho, ho, ho.
It's Christmas time again.
Let's see what's on TV.
It's Christmas time again.
Well, we got Rudolph, Frosty.
It's Christmas time again.
Rudolph versus Frosty.
It's Christmas time again.
A CSI Christmas.
The Christmas season causes great frustration, getting longer and harder like a Viagra patient. I just need a vacation from the holiday cheer, and I don't think that I can take it for the rest of the year. And nobody is cheerful anyway. It's always give me the damn toys and get the fuck out my way. I can deal with that on December 23rd, but when it starts up in March, that's a little absurd. And then the charities, there's way too many begging me for money like I have any. And there's some idiot flapping his mouth like a flapjack with his peace on earth and all that crap. I'd settle for peace in the kitchen, but that would mean my relatives would have to quit their bitching. And since I doubt that'll ever come about, it's Merry Christmas, pass the gravy, and I try to tune them out.
It's Christmas time again.
Alright, let's see what Santa brought for me.
It's Christmas time again.
Huh, I already have one of these.
It's Christmas time again.
Hey, wait a minute, this is mine.
It's Christmas time again.
I've been looking for this.
Christmas usually consists of this: fighting back the urge to shop with my fist, sending out cards to people I never see, and trying to keep the dog from peeing on the tree. And then the whole family has to search for directions so we can find our way to church. I still find it ironic and a little bit odd that my kids believe in Santa Claus but not in God. But I ain't taking my kids, cause it's too weird to see some child molester in a fake beard. I don't care if they kick and scream, I ain't doing anything till after Halloween. I can only buy damaged and discount due to the amount in my bank account, but I have no motivation to shop when I know I'm still paying off gifts from 3 Christmases ago.
It's Christmas time again.
And again, and again, and again, and again.
It's Christmas time again.
And again, and again, and again, and again.
It's Christmas time again.
And again, and again, and again, and again.
It's Christmas time again.
What do you mean again? More like still.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.